This episode is supported by Active Skin Repair. Active Skin Repair is a skin health company helping people heal with natural, non-toxic, medical-grade ingredients. I just randomly, Vinny was having a toe skin irritation issue, and he ended up having this like skin that was really irritating him, and it was getting kind of like icky, and you know, like when kids start to get like little scabs and scratches and then they want to pick at it, and it was getting worse. And so Active Skin Repair showed up on my doorstep as a result of the sponsorship, and I got to put it to use immediately. And I got the ointment formula, or the like ointment formulation, and then also the spray, and the spray was perfect. So Vinny does not like ointmenty, creamy, lotiony things on his body, but I was able to get out the spray, literally took it out of the packaging the day it arrived, put it on his toe before he went to bed. And the next morning he was like, "Mom, my toe's all better." It was literally like this super amazing cure that helped his toes so quickly. So you can use Active Skin Repair on a wide range of skin issues, including cuts, scrapes, burns, sunburns, rashes, other types of skin damage. It's totally safe, non-toxic, suitable on all types of skin, even parts of the body where you might have rosacea or eczema or have acne-prone skin. This is also safe for the youngest members of your family up to the oldest. So now you have one simple solution for your family's skin health needs. With over 500,000 happy customers and thousands of five-star reviews and super safe and clean ingredients, Active Skin Repair is something that you want to have on hand for your family. So to get your own Active Skin Repair, go to activeskinrepair.com to learn more about Active Skin Repair and get 20% off your order when you use the code SHAMELESS. That's activeskinrepair.com. Use the code SHAMELESS for 20% off your order. activeskinrepair.com, code SHAMELESS. This is the Shameless Mom Academy, episode 863, with Julie and Ryan Neal. Show notes for this episode, including any links mentioned in the episode, can be found by going to shamelessmom.com and clicking on episode 863. Welcome to the Shameless Mom Academy. I'm your host, Sarah Dean. I'm here to give you and other passionate, driven, unapologetic moms tools, resources, and a little bit of humor to help you lead more positive, powerful, and purposeful lives every damn day. One of the best things about the Shameless Mom Academy is our community, so be sure to join us in our free private Facebook group to connect with other shameless moms just like you. You can find us over at shamelessmom.com/Facebook. All right, let's dive into today's episode. Julie Neal is a returning guest to the Shameless Mom Academy, and she is a life and leadership coach, mom to two neurodivergent boys, and the creator of Mother's Quest, as well as the Mother's Quest podcast and the Live Your Epic Year Planner. Started in 2016, Mother's Quest provides inspiration, coaching, and community for mothers who want to live their vision of an epic life while raising their children. At the age of 50, Julie received a diagnosis of ADHD, realizing that she herself is also neurodivergent. The diagnosis explained a lot and has provided a window for her to better understand what it's like for her children to try to embrace their differences while finding strategies to address the challenges that come alongside. This year, Julie is serving on the UCLA Parents Council and looks forward to working alongside her son Ryan from a parent perspective to support neurodivergent students and their families at UCLA. Ryan Neal, Julie's son, is a neurodivergent sophomore at UCLA, planning to double major in communication and disability studies with a minor in film studies. He is part of the College Scholars Program at UCLA and was recently selected as part of the 2023 Chancellor's Leadership Program cohort. He is passionate about neurodiversity advocacy and sharing his own experiences to pave the way for others. He's currently a staff member at the Bruin Resource Center, where he is a student lead on a new campus-wide neurodiversity initiative to make UCLA more inclusive for students like him. This last summer, he served on the staff for the Stanford Neurodiversity Project Research, Education, and Advocacy Camp for high schoolers who are wanting to create neurodiversity advocacy projects. He was also a speaker at the 2021 Stanford Neurodiversity Summit and has been a guest host on the Mother's Quest podcast. Ryan was diagnosed with autism at the age of 18 months old, and he also identifies with ADHD and anxiety. Knowing Julie, I knew this would be a fantastic conversation. I've actually heard Julie and Ryan in conversation on Julie's Mother Quest podcast, so I knew this was going to be really special. We started talking about this conversation, gosh, like probably a year and a half ago. And when we did the recording, I started considering when we would release this episode. And I thought, oh my gosh, we have to do it in April because April is Autism Awareness Month, April 2nd being Autism Awareness Day. So I was really, really honored and really excited to have Ryan and Julie here to talk about neurodiversity, including autism, and all that Ryan is doing to build inclusive spaces for kids like him on college campuses. This kid is up to so many. You're going to feel inadequate when you hear all the things Ryan's doing. He's up to so many things. I was so blown away. And it's really, really incredible to hear his enthusiasm, his excitement, and his deep, deep commitment to neurodiversity advocacy. And Julie is just right there next to him, his biggest cheerleader and championing every step that he's taking, but also really staying in it with him in order to support parents of kids like Ryan and support parents across college campuses who are also navigating neurodiversity and neurodiversity advocacy. So listen in to hear Ryan and Julie share Ryan's optimism around the neurodiversity movement, especially in collegiate environments, Ryan's autism diagnosis at 18 months and his experience of learning about his diagnosis when he was 13, Ryan's disconnection from his diagnosis given his propensity for very rich conversations with others, how Julie was diagnosed with ADHD when going through menopause, the difference in the ways Ryan and Julie accepted and integrated their respective diagnoses, what Ryan's transition into college life has been like, and how Ryan has leapt in to neurodiversity advocacy at UCLA. This was such a special conversation. So huge thank you to Ryan and to Julie, of course, for engaging in this conversation. We don't get to have younger student age people here very often. So this was such a special treat. And again, I'm just so completely honored and so grateful. So with all that, please welcome Julie Neal and Ryan Neal to the Shameless Mom Academy. Julie and Ryan, welcome to the Shameless Mom Academy. I'm so thrilled to have both of you here today. Julie as a return guest and Ryan as a new guest.
Thank you, Sarah. I was saying this is the first time that Ryan and I have been together on a podcast that is not my own. So we're having a moment and I'm so appreciative and I'm excited about this opportunity.
I'm so excited. And Ryan, we don't typically get kids in like air quotes. Kids/young adults perspective, but like a child of one of our parents. We don't often get that perspective. So thank you for your openness to this conversation.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Yeah, first, I totally understand the colloquial kid. I'm really excited to keep sharing my mom and I's story. She's an incredible woman, as you know, you've interviewed her before and been a huge part of my neurodiversity journey, a journey that a lot of people are going on kind of all right now, all of a sudden. So I'm thrilled to add my voice to the conversation.
Thank you. So I always like to ask people a little bit beyond their bio just to kick us off. And because just in our pre-interview, both of you were talking about things that are coming up and things that you're excited about and cool things that have happened recently. So can you start with sharing one thing that you're each excited about right now? And Ryan, why don't you go ahead and go first?
Yeah, I'm probably most excited about just the neurodiversity movement as a whole and how it's progressing. Our society, especially in America, has been grappling with complex issues of different groups that haven't been heard for a long time. And neurodiversity, people with different functioning brains, is starting to come to the forefront of these conversations, especially on college campuses like where I'm at. And I've always wanted to live a life of some degree of significance. Like, I wouldn't want to just be another consultant at some giant firm who doesn't make an impact. I want to be somewhere where I feel I'm making a splash. And as a neurodivergent person myself, I'm just excited all the possibilities in the neurodiversity movement, especially at UCLA where I'm attending, and kind of laying some of the groundwork of how University of California as a system can better serve neurodivergent students. It just feels like there's limitless possibilities in this area, limitless ways for me to contribute.
I love it. And your bio also indicates that there are limitless opportunities and that you're open and willing and ready to find all of them, which I'm really excited to talk about. Julie, what about you? What are you most excited about right now?
So Friday was my birthday and it was a big milestone. I love to make meaning of moments in our lives. So I turned 52. The Mother's Quest podcast was a birthday present I gave to myself at age 45. So it was Mother's Quest's 7th birthday. I hit 100 episodes, which is a big milestone for me. And yeah. I did it with an episode with this incredible woman, Valerie Kaur. She's the author of See No Stranger and the creator of the Revolution Love Project. And so it was that episode really encompassed like everything that mattered to me when I created the podcast about finding my own voice and being able to amplify the important messages of other amazing mothers. And I'm also launching my 2024 planners, and there's just a lot of seeds that I've planted over time, and I'm beginning to see how they're growing in powerful ways. And then I get to watch seeds planted by Ryan. I feel like, Ryan, you're really hitting your stride, and so many things are coming together for you, and none of it's easy. So when we have these moments when we can see the fulfillment of a lot of our hard work and our dreams coming true, it's really amazing. And I like to try to bottle those up. I call them epic snapshot moments, and I hold on to them as long as I can, because I know around the corner things will feel hard again soon.
I love that acknowledgement. Like, I'm going to enjoy this right now because we know this, all moments are fleeting, for better or worse. Thank you both for that. I love hearing about the momentum in your lives, seeing the things that I get to see on social media, seeing the momentum. Julie, happy belated birthday, and happy belated birthday to Mother's Quest. And 100 episodes. So exciting. All of those milestones are so significant. So, and also like got to lead us to this place where we get to be here today in this conversation. So that's something that I'm excited about.
Thank you, Sarah.
I want to dig in and talk about the process of discovery around neurodivergence. Mm. So I was diagnosed with ADHD last year, and then like 2 years before that with anxiety, but all of the things had been present forever. So I love hearing other people's stories, kind of hearing, how did you discover this? What did that feel like after, you know, kind of receiving this information about yourself? So I would love to hear from each of you, both of you identifying as neurodivergent. How did each of you discover that you were neurodivergent? Ryan, I know you were really young, so your mom might need to share some of that journey. And then also, how have your respective diagnoses impacted your lives? Which is like a whole life story question. So in small ways, like, or in big ways, but in a concise way, how has that impacted your life? And whoever wants to go first can jump in.
I feel like I can probably go first, and then mom, if you want to interject, you can. So I think for most people with neurodivergence, especially with autism, which is my diagnosis, you kind of either have that really early diagnosis and kind of having that knowledge carry you through your life, or you get diagnosed late and you're kind of recontextualizing all your life moments prior. And for me, I kind of had both experiences, because I was diagnosed at 18 months, but I didn't find out I was autistic until I was 13. So,
wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I got the best or worst of both worlds, whatever you want to describe it. For those of you who don't know, 18 months is just about the earliest one could be diagnosed with autism. So I like to say I was just a really autistic baby. I look back on home videos where it's like my parents are trying to engage and play with me, and I just didn't realize I was supposed to do that. Mm. I'm like, I just want to bang my head up against this wall because like I like how it feels on my skin. And they're saying my name, but what even is a name anyways?
Yeah.
And I can't imagine how freaked out they were. That's like, this kid doesn't even know we exist. If I was just in my own little world.
Wow.
So I was diagnosed then. And from then all the way through at least 7, I had a lot of very intensive early intervention. I had something called ABA therapy, which is a type of autism intervention that certainly at the time was essentially the standard practice. But now looking back, a lot of autistic adults like myself who'd experienced it have, to be polite, very mixed feelings about the treatment. Because what it does is it uses positive and negative reinforcement to change one's behaviors to fit neurotypical societal social expectations, to fit what makes other people comfortable, not what actually enhances the autistic person's life. I remember when I was 5, I went somewhere called Cool School, which was funny at the time, but it's really kind of a cruel name looking at it, looking back, where there was this superhero called Super Flex, and he was the paragon of flexible thinking, and he was fighting all these kind of cartoon villains, which embody different autistic traits like rigid thinking, making jokes at inopportune times, having meltdowns, getting distracted. And they really made it like a game, a mission to eradicate these behaviors, these traits that while yes, can cause problems in certain environments, are just the natural way I thought and processed the world. And I was a smart kid. I had great pattern recognition. I really took a lot of these lessons to heart. And it resulted in just throughout my development, me being very, very acutely socially conscious and socially anxious to really an extreme extent where by the time I reached kind of early adolescence, where I found out about my diagnosis, I just, in every single interaction, I was just processing so much and paying attention to so many different cues and doing my best to avoid making anyone feel any negative emotions at all whatsoever. And then, so I alluded to when I was 13, I found out I was autistic. I didn't even know. And when I found out, I really had to go back and reevaluate just different moments in my life. Graduation parties I wasn't invited to, people who wouldn't sit next to me at recess, different moments where a teacher was sarcastic in class and I didn't understand it. People thought I was being a smart ass, but I was like, I just really don't know what he means.
Yeah.
And from then to now, the journey has really been about grappling with not just autism as a set of symptoms on a diagnostic manual, but autism, the word and the term and the baggage that comes with it. Because at the time, and even largely now, autism was thought of as someone like Rain Man, who could have some brilliant gift, but can't connect with others, can't feel emotions or empathy. We have people like Sheldon Cooper from The Big Bang Theory, who throughout the entire run of the show is just constantly being rude and disrespectful based on not understanding social cues. It was just associated with not being loved and accepted. And as someone who's always craved connection, that was kind of a hard pill to swallow. It kind of felt like a bit of a death sentence for what I wanted my life to be, which was rich in connection. So from 13 to around 19, I really did my best to try to place myself as far from that term as possible. I'm like, oh, autistic people struggle to connect with others. I'm going to try to make friends with every single person at my school, and regardless of how tired it makes me and how I crash at the end of the day. Autistic people aren't in the center of social life. I'll go to all the parties. I'll go to all the football games. I'll join the basketball team. I'll do whatever it takes. And just all these things, it made me feel like I was more normal, like I was connecting with people, like this label wasn't holding me back. But my response to it was, because I was exhausting myself trying to mask my autistic features, making constant eye contact and paying attention to inflection and cues and all that stuff. And it reached a boiling point in college where I was just absolutely burning the candle at both ends, not paying attention to my self-care, my health, my studies, just constantly seeking socially normative interactions. And it reached a point where my body literally gave out. I got mono and I got sick. I had to go home. I almost had to drop all my classes. And at that point, I just kind of had to look at myself and I'm like, okay, however scary being autistic and living up to that label is, maybe at this point, it's not as scary as just running away from that and literally taxing my body to try to meet an expectation that I can't meet. So at this point, I'm kind of trying to pivot into more acceptance of myself and my autistic traits and even some of the stigma that comes along with it. And that's all things that we can probably get into later, but just the duality of getting diagnosed so early, but also finding out so late and grappling with all that. That's, I think, been just a real key component of my journey.
This episode is supported by Mysteries About True Histories, a podcast for your kiddos. So from the creators of the hit podcast Who Smarted and Netflix's Brainchild comes the adventurous world of Mysteries About True Histories, affectionately known as MATH. Every episode follows Max and Molly, who have just been recruited into a secret order of problem solvers on an adventure through time packed with puzzles, hidden equations, history, and laughs, making learning cool. This podcast is perfect for ages 6 and up, and new episodes drop every Thursday, each stacked with so much laughter that your kiddos won't even realize how much they're learning. I love a show where, as a parent, you're like, hey, let's listen or watch this or whatever, and your kids are thinking they're like getting extra device time or what have you, and you're like, they're learning right now. So it feels like such a big win. So I want you to go check out Mysteries About True Histories wherever you listen to podcasts. You can tune into Mysteries About True Histories with your kids. You can follow and listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, wherever you're listening to this podcast. So go check out Mysteries About True Histories to listen in and have some fun with your kid while they learn today. This episode is supported by a podcast I want to share with you called Understood Explains. So this show is about navigating ADHD, dyslexia, and other learning and thinking differences, which can be so confusing. And so every season of the show is around a different theme. So there's a season on special education, there's a season on ADHD diagnosis for adults, and the current season is all about IEPs. I love this podcast because the episodes are 10 to 15 minutes long. So if you are short on time or short on focus, you can take this content in super quickly, easily. It's very digestible. And the show is hosted by teacher and special education expert, Juliana Urtube. So Juliana talks all about how to navigate educational plans, IEPs. She talks about the differences between IEPs and 504 plans. She really breaks things down in a really clear and simple way so that you have some of those questions that you might be thinking around, like, does this pertain to my child? Is this something I need to be looking into? Like, where do we go from here? Where do I go if I have questions? Juliana has you covered. She explains so many different things and so many different little pieces and nuance of IEPs and special education and different things on Understood Explains. So I want you to go check it out wherever you're listening to this podcast. You can go listen to Understood Explains. Just go into your podcast app, do a search for Understood Explains, and it will pop right up. Click on it, pick your episode, and get the answers that you've been looking for and the support that you need around different learning differences and differences in school. Thank you for sharing so many layers to your life in that response. I'm super blown away. I think that we have, and you referenced this, we have ideas of what we think autism looks like in a cultural, societal way. And your example of Rain Man was a really good one. And so we have these like preconceived notions, and you just made that vision so much more expansive, but you also did it with being really vulnerable about the ways that you had awareness around your diagnosis, mm-hmm. and then fought against it and really tried to overcome a lot of those cultural, I was going to say predispositions, but cultural
misconceptions.
Thank you. I might ask you for more words later. Cultural misconceptions. And that's so helpful. I think that this, like hearing stories like this, I think really, really helps us all see a bigger picture, a more complete picture, a more accurate picture. We also get to see layers of humanity behind a diagnosis, mm-hmm. in which like no two people with any diagnosis are going to look the same. So thank you so much for all that you shared in that response. I really appreciate it. And we are going to, you said we might get into this later. We're going to get into more later. So just hold on. I have follow-up questions, but I really appreciate
ready and
that.
Waiting.
I know you, I've heard you in interviews, so I know what a thoughtful interviewee you are. So I'm excited to go deeper. But first, Julie, tell us about your experience being with your diagnosis and kind of your journey into neurodivergence as well.
Well, first of all, I want to acknowledge, Ryan, all you shared as a mom. Every time I hear you talk about your journey, it's really, you know, there are lots of moments where I feel so much sadness for decisions that I made or ways that I viewed autism as a parent that have really shifted over the years. And yeah, so I have part of me has regret when I hear you talk. And then part of me just honors the complete and total journey that you've been on. And I know that you would not be the version of who you are today with all of your experiences and all your lessons learned without the journey. So I just want to acknowledge every time you share, I think I take away something else, and I'm always grateful for it. Like you said, Sarah, I have been neurodivergent my whole life, but I didn't always know it. Of course, you know, Ryan was diagnosed at a young age and he's 19 now. So I think I started to learn more about neurodiversity, and maybe I would see some aspects of how he shows up in the world and myself. But it really wasn't until I went through menopause, which I now know can really exacerbate ADHD symptoms in women, that things came to like such a point that I sought support and really began to think, maybe I actually have this diagnosis. I was always the kid. I was like the kid that didn't get into trouble at all, like the sweetest, most well-behaved child, except my mom would get mad at me because I would lose my sweatshirts. I would get stains on my clothes. I would, you know, leave important things behind all the time. And so it was this really what I now know is a more like distracted version of ADHD. And it followed me my whole life. I had a boyfriend who invited me on a cruise with his family, and I arrived to the cruise to Mexico without my passport. My sister had to like drive it over.
Not funny in the moment, but funny to look back on.
No, but those things, you know, just happened to me my whole life. And I just now in retrospect, I say, you know, I think my family was just like, oh, that's Julie. And I'm like, didn't that ever seem a little odd to you? And, you know, even at my wedding, when my sisters gave the toast, they made a joke about how Chris, my husband, is like my low jack, like he's the finder of all my things. Thankfully, I married a very like neurotypical, highly capable person in a lot of the ways that are the things that are challenging for me.
So he's the most neurotypical man alive. It's kind of astounding.
We need to do an interview with him. I want a whole interview, just his perspective on living this life.
I just want to say there's a funny joke that runs in our family where we all, like me, my mom, my brother, we all have our neurodivergence. And my dad says, no, I'm neurodivergent too. I have decision fatigue. Because he has to make decisions for all three of us. So now that's kind of a running joke that he's an honorary member of the neurodivergence. Yes.
So thankfully, we have a wonderful psychiatrist for both of my children. And at one point I said, could I have a conversation with you about myself? And, you know, he kind of ran through all of the questions. He talked to Chris and, you know, fairly soon after arrived at a very clear picture that he was certain I do have ADHD. So I got that diagnosis. I can't remember if I was 49 or 50, but it's fairly new. So again, living with the characteristics of it, but it all got so much harder to hold together, I think, which is very common. Yeah. I hear this from so many moms. Like if you're a mother and all the things that come with that, I'm the mom of two neurodivergent kids and all the things that come with the advocacy and the supporting them. I have my own entrepreneurial venture, which I'm so passionate about. So then there's another layer there. And then you add in the what happens to your brain with menopause and when your hormones change and all of these things become much harder to manage. So I finally hit the point where I felt like I needed to seek more information. And I have access to medication, which for various reasons I still don't totally understand. I don't use. I just went on hormone replacement therapy, which I've heard can be very helpful. And I'm kind of hopeful to see what might shift in terms of how my brain functions with that. But more than that, I feel like I've been able to understand myself better and seek out, you know, different kinds of supports, like what kinds of things work for people who have ADHD and try some new strategies, which, you know, I feel like it is a continual work in progress.
I agree. On all of the above from my experience as well. I've connected a lot of dots. But it is so interesting having a diagnosis later in life and how it kind of shifts your identity and you can look back and look on things differently. But interestingly, Ryan, when I talk about a diagnosis later in life and in reference to like two women who are middle age, you learning about your diagnosis of autism at age 13 also is kind of learning about a diagnosis later in life, given that you're 19 now, like that was later in life for you. And it sounds like you were also able to connect dots once you knew that in ways that were, it sounds like really challenging and emotionally overwhelming to recognize like, oh, this is why that happened, or here's why I didn't fit here or there, which is obviously really significant in a kid's development. But I'm also curious for you if connecting those dots was helpful or provided any, I want to use the word relief, because that's what I have felt, but I also don't want to put words in your mouth. So what do you identify with feeling like, oh, that's why that's that way. And like things kind of clicking and making sense.
I don't know if relief is the right word, because there's a lot of similarities between autism and ADHD, but one of the differences really is the societal stigma.
Yeah.
Especially because we are predominantly social creatures, and a lot of the way that society judges each other is on our ability to socialize and connect with others. So when I got that diagnosis, it made a lot of things make sense. I don't know if I'd say it was a relief, because it added this other burden and concern and fear to me. But That being said, I'm still so grateful that I do know, because it's allowed me to understand where some of my shortcomings are and where my struggles are, not just socially, but academically, with my executive functioning challenges, with my ADHD symptoms. Because for those of you who don't know, autism and ADHD have a lot of shared symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think it's also allowed me to give myself a little bit of grace when I come up against the wall, because if I didn't know I was autistic and I was finding my social battery, my social stamina is so much less than those around me, I feel so much more struggle to get my tasks done, to get my food, to make my laundry, to keep on top of my school assignments. And if I didn't have a diagnosis, a lot of these struggles would probably be looked at through the lens of discipline and work ethic and personal yeah. responsibility, which puts all of the blame on an individual's problems and struggles on themselves mm-hmm. and what they're not doing well enough. Where instead, this diagnosis, having it known to myself and my family, it makes it so I'm not constantly blaming myself for everything that goes on, because I have some degree of understanding that there's some things outside of my control, because I do think differently and process differently. And I'm in environments like a 30,000 plus student academic institution that doesn't necessarily cater to that way of thinking. So I think it's given myself and those around me the opportunity to give me a little grace.
When I hear you talk, Ryan, and I was just thinking this as you were speaking right now, but it's something that I couldn't quite put a label on, as I've heard you being interviewed on your mom's show a couple times. I'm curious if anyone has ever told you that you come across as equal parts sociologist, anthropologist, and like either psychologist or psychiatrist, in terms of how you can take a concept, idea, theory, and integrate it into social patterns and like come up with a way to talk about it that makes so much sense, but is so layered in the way you're able to dig in and connect it in various ways.
Yeah. First of all, thank you.
So you should definitely be triple majoring is what I'm saying.
you should go speak to my professors. He's a psychologist, a sociologist, an anthropologist. Yes. I think there's a few things behind that. First of all, I have had the true privilege of having been in therapy since I was 9 years old with an absolutely brilliant therapist named Dr. Callum Eastwood, where the way I put it in therapy, what I'm doing is I'm taking my thoughts and trying to distill them into words and then convey them to someone on the other end in a way that they understand so they can help me. And I've been doing that an hour a week, 52 weeks a year for the past 10 years. So I feel like that's given me this gift where whatever neural pathway, whatever highway runs between my thoughts and my words has, I think, really developed because I've just kind of worked at it. And if it wasn't for those years of therapy and having a family that has the resources to invest in that type of support, I don't think I'd be able to express myself in the way I am today. The second thing, and this is something that a gift that autism itself has given me, and I'm sure other autistic people probably feel similarly, is because social rules, norms, and functions haven't come naturally to me, I've kind of had to learn them from scratch in a way. Like, I almost equate it to the difference between buying a computer versus building one yourself. Building your own computer can be more expensive, more time consuming, more difficult, and there may have to be more maintenance involved than just buying a computer that comes with everything preset. But in the process of building your own computer, you have just a much more intimate understanding of the inner workings of that machine than someone who just buys a MacBook. Yeah. So because I've constantly had to been, okay, this is what this person's saying, but what do they mean? What is the context behind them saying it? What are the background info for it? I think it's given, I wish I had an example on the top of my head. I'm usually better at this.
The computer example is a really great example. That makes a ton of sense. But
well, that's an analogy, not an example.
Oh, sorry. See, look at sociologist, anthropologist. He's like, let me correct you.
Sorry.
I totally appreciate it. I love it. I'm giving you a hard time because you're totally right. I'm like, no. Let me tell you about an analogy, and I appreciate the correction. That absolutely makes sense. And I can see how you get the opportunity to create and build, but also the immense amount of work and energy and effort and thoughtfulness and decision-making and intentionality around if I'm building this from scratch and I'm going to, you know, integrate these different pieces and then have them all work together in a certain way so that then I can, you know, fit in a certain way or be able to function a certain way. That's a lot to have ownership over as a young person.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's also the thing where if we lived in a society that was more understanding and appreciative of neurodivergence, ADHD and autism included, then that wouldn't need to be the case. It's a byproduct of an imperfect society. And in a weird way, one of my life goals is to make it so future autistic children aren't so metacognitive and ethnographic because they won't need to be.
Can you explain both of those words for people that don't know what they mean?
I used to, quick little bit of context, when I was in eighth grade, my history teacher used to call me big words, no substance.
I love big words, so I'm excited right now.
I do too. I didn't, it's an autism thing. I didn't realize that just because I knew a word, other people might not know that. That just wasn't a thing that registered to me. So just every now and then I'll use a word. I'm like, oh, just because I know it doesn't mean people know it. For context, metacognitive is just the word used to describe how one thinks about their own thoughts, how one thinks about their own thought process. And ethnography, honestly, no, I did kind of throw that one around. I kind of know what it feels like it means. I think it's just kind of a word that refers to being kind of conscious and thoughtful about the way societal patterns and functions work.
Oh, I love both. I'm a sociology major, so I probably maybe learned those words at one point 30 years ago. But metacognition, I know I attract a lot of women who are overthinkers and overanalyzers, and all of our listeners who identify that way right now are thinking, metacognition, oh my gosh, I'm like really good at that. Like, I'm really good at paying attention to like, what am I thinking? Why am I thinking it? How am I thinking it? Am I thinking too much? Not enough.
Yeah, like there's a word for that.
Yeah. So now we all know. We can all analyze our metacognition on a regular basis.
You're welcome, listeners.
Exactly. I want to talk a little bit about your transition into post-home life and into the world of college and living away from home. And I want to shift back to you, Julie. And if you want to kick us off here, and then Ryan, I'll pass it back to you. I would love to know, Julie, what was it like having your sending your child, dropping your child off? And I got to watch all this unfold on social media, by the way, dropping your child off at college. And I know that you have a ton of confidence in Ryan and his skills and abilities, but also, as you mentioned earlier, when you have children with neurodiversities, like there's a lot of work that goes into making sure that they're cared for in all these different ways over the course of their lives. And then to drop them off in a dorm and be like, okay, bye. It's a massive transition for both of you. So can Julie, do you want to talk a little bit about what that was like for you in terms of letting Ryan launch? And then I would love to hear Ryan, your take as well.
So I've had two experiences now because he's a sophomore. So last year, I think I was first filled with like the most tremendous, just like pride. Chris and I had both also gone to UCLA. So it was this like completely full circle moment. My dad had passed away and I knew how much he would be excited that Ryan was back in LA and like a few blocks from my mom and your family there. So there was a tremendous amount of excitement. And then when I left, a tremendous amount of fear. And as I started to watch the quarter unfold and saw Ryan like, you know, really putting himself out there and but in ways in which I felt like he wasn't being completely authentic to himself. It was very hard for me. And, you know, I had a moment where I realized, oh my God, this is not healthy. I need help. And it caused me to seek out a therapist who I've now been working with since. So last year it was a roller coaster ride, you know, from like this like most hopeful moment to then like seeing what unfolded, feeling like I was watching a train that was about to crash and not feeling like I could do that much about it when in the past I had been able to be more of a protector and to control things more. And then trying to trust that like this is part of his journey. Mm-hmm. And then he actually came home because he was so sick and I couldn't actually be at school. And so then that was the strange experience of like, in some ways I was like, ah, he's here and I can take care of him again. And we had a lot of special time. We watched every season of Game of Thrones together. But it was hard. You know, it was so hard to see like the things that he had built kind of like unravel and then have him go back winter quarter and try to put back his life together there again. Fast forward to the second year, I feel like we were both in completely different places. There were a lot of things Ryan had put into place and had learned so that he was starting the year in a completely different way. I already had my therapist on board. I had lessons learned. We did this spark session where he and I shared our lessons learned together and shared it with other people, which became, you know, as an ADHD person, you have this like need to know urgency to do the work. And so it created this like urgency for us to actually slow down and talk about like, okay, what do we know now? We also co-created this map for him of like all of his supports and agreements about like, what does wellness look like? What are the markers of these things are happening? We know you're okay. What do you do if you're feeling burnt out? What do you do if you're feeling depressed? Like we were just able to put on paper all these details that we had learned together across the year. But I guess the other thing I would say is I think there are so many messages out there. And I know that Sarah, you and I have both interviewed Julie Lithcott-Hames, who's just this masterful writer and thought leader around parenting and what it looks like when you're helicopter parenting and you're trying to control too much. And I think there are definitely times where I am trying to control too much and I need to go back and read Julie's book. But I also think that when you have a neurodivergent child or maybe a child who has other kinds of different needs, that expecting that when they go off to college, you're just going to like completely let go and know they can figure it all out themselves also doesn't feel, there's a way in which that mindset isn't inclusive because it doesn't reflect the true reality of what kind of supports are needed for some students. So I've also kind of come to terms with like, okay, it may not look like what it looks like for some of my other parents who send their kids off to college. And how can I both show up for Ryan and help be an advocate and build in more supports for him while also noticing like, when are the times that I need to step back? And I would say one of my most recent realizations that happened through my therapy session was this realization that I have this internal alarm system from being Ryan's parent for all these years that goes off when it's like danger, danger, like things are about to fall apart. And I know that I'm part of the like what it looks like to put things back together. And that this year, my alarm system has been needed to be recalibrated because it was going off when it didn't need to, because Ryan's in a very different place.
Yeah. Thank you for that. This episode is supported by AquaTrue. Having clean, safe water is the last thing you want to worry about. But unfortunately, according to extensive research by the Environmental Working Group, 3 out of 4, yes, 3 out of 4 homes in America have harmful contaminants in their tap water. So that's why you got to check out AquaTrue. AquaTrue purifiers have a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers, which is what we have, take no installation or plumbing, and they remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. And they're specifically designed to combat chemicals like PFAS, which can lead to potentially adverse health effects like cancer, endocrine system disruption, and liver toxicity, which is part of what makes AquaTrue so special, unique, and important in terms of how they are able to filter water. They also have water purifiers to fit every type of home. So like the installation-free countertop purifier that we have at our house to higher capacity under sink options. They even have Wi-Fi connected purifiers and mineral boost options. So I'm so excited about our new AquaTrue. And here's the thing. I swear it's like a gentle reminder to actually drink more water every time you walk into your kitchen. So we are drinking more water now and also more clean water. So more water that is more clean. It feels like a double win. I'm feeling pretty impressed with us. I feel like sink water, tap water becomes invisible at a certain point. And when I see the purifier on my counter, it's like many time a day reminder to like, keep drinking, keep drinking. So I want you to check out AquaTrue for yourself and for your family. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money back guarantee, and that makes it a great gift as well. Today, my listeners can receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier when you go to AquaTrue.com. That's AquaTru.com and enter the code Shameless at checkout. That's 20% off any AquaTrue purifier when you go to AquaTrue.com and use the code Shameless, S-H-A-M-E-L-E-S-S. AquaTrue.com, code Shameless. This episode is supported by Nutrafol. Did you know that hair thinning will happen to approximately 1 in 2 women? If you're among them, you are not alone. Thinning hair is normal, but it's not openly talked about, so it can feel lonely and frustrating and sometimes even embarrassing when you're going through it yourself. Join the over 1 million people who are doing something about their thinning hair with Nutrafol. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist-recommended hair growth supplement, with over 1 million people seeing thicker, stronger, faster-growing hair with less shedding. Oh my gosh, I am a heavy shedder, so if you are a heavy shedder, or if you are someone who's wanting to thicken your hair, I definitely want you to try out Nutrafol. I have loved using it myself, and I know multiple other people have used it and have found great results. While many supplements rely solely on ingredient studies, Nutrafol clinically tests final formulations to ensure their efficacy. In a clinical study, 86% of women reported improved hair growth after taking Nutrafol Women's Hair Growth Supplement for 6 months. To get started, you can take their hair quiz on Nutrafol.com, which will give you a personalized health plan based on your special root causes. Nutrafol is committed to helping you identify root causes of any shedding or hair loss so that you can really start to rebuild healthy hair in a way that is customized to you. So take the first steps to visibly thicker, healthier hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code SHAMELESS. Find out why 4,500 healthcare professionals and hairstylists recommend Nutrafol for healthier hair. Go to Nutrafol.com. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code SHAMELESS. Nutrafol.com, code SHAMELESS. Ryan, can you share a little bit about the transition into college for you? And I would love for you to also fold into that what you're doing in terms of neurodivergence advocacy at UCLA. Because it sounds like you've kind of jumped into that space pretty quickly and excitedly. So I would love to hear a little bit about both of those things. I'm noticing the time. I want to have like 2 more hours. So in our last few minutes, if you want to go ahead and share that with us.
Yeah, I'll hustle. Well, I'm glad my kind of initial tangent touched on some of the college stuff. So I feel like I'm not like, oh, I'm missing key chunks of details. Because the first thing, I kind of want to reaffirm what my mom just said about kind of the standards and expectations that most people have for neurotypical students becoming adults and entering college and the support or lack thereof they need. It's not a one size fits all, not even for neurotypical students. People don't really understand this, but the way our mind and body develops, our maturity develops, it's not all aligned with our chronology. As in, like, I'm 19. I think there are aspects of myself in the way I think and process that are older than my years, more developed than my chronological age. But my self-care, emotional regulation, executive functioning is just, to put it bluntly, far younger. So early on, we ran into some trouble spots where they were expecting me to be a 19-year-old in every way. I'm like, no, but I feel like my ability to get food and do laundry and all that, it feels more like closer to like a 15 or 16 year old. And so how would you parent a 15, 16 year old in that regard? And it would be maybe a little more support, maybe a little more hands-on. So that's how we kind of transitioned from me kind of holding the burden for everything and having it be an ethic or responsibility for independence to maybe we DoorDash a couple more meals. Maybe I go to my grandma's to do some laundry. Maybe we hire a coach or a tutor to help me keep on track of my assignments or look at academics. Maybe we should really apply for accommodations at UCLA and actually request and ask for them and believe them deserving of them. Because UCLA is a hard school to get into. And coming in, I had this mindset that's like, I need to perform and achieve and do this on my own. And you have to have a little bit of humility, even as a neurodivergent person, to ask for help and supports that you know other students around you aren't getting, but you know that it's for the overall equity because there are things that you're struggling with that are invisible that people can't see. So that's where I feel on the support end. In terms of the advocacy, that area, I'm kind of in some ways grateful for the way my first quarter kind of flamed out, because coming back into my second, third quarter freshman year, I was really a little bit more on my own socially, academically, in all those regards. And I realized I wanted more structure and more support around my autism at UCLA, but also I wanted community and self-actualization. I'd have all these friends and acquaintances and colleagues who are able to access like culture centers and clubs and organizations around LGBT identities, racial identities, religious identities. And I'm like, well, the percentage of the population at UCLA that belongs to these identities is relatively similar to neurodivergence, because it's autism around 1 to 2% of UC undergrad population. This was from a UC Davis study, around 4% or so for ADHD. Like, we're a minority group, but of 30 so thousand students, there are thousands of us. But there was just this gaping hole where there should be these organizations and frameworks that give us somewhere to go and engage in shared community and identity and support each other. And I just saw that there wasn't something like that. So my mom and I, we didn't necessarily go into some of these conversations with the Center for Accessible Education at our school. We weren't necessarily going, here's our pitch for how we can create a neurodiversity initiative. But we were talking about all these things that we need: more institutional support, community engagement, having neurodivergent inclusive spaces. And they were listening and kind of taking notes. And they're like, well, why don't you start something? So that's kind of what I did. I partnered with the head of Center for Accessible Education and the head of this thing called the Bruin Resource Center, which is kind of a sect of UCLA that focuses on a certain underrepresented groups, that for like undocumented students, students in foster care, students with dependents, that means students who have children of their own. And for the past quarter, we've been working on building a neurodiversity initiative, which is the first of its kind at UCLA to be exclusively neurodivergent student-led, but also administratively supported. And we're joining a growing list of institutions like Stanford with their neurodiversity project, and UC Davis, which is doing a ton of great work in this area. But from some of my research, there aren't a lot of organizations like us with our aspirations. And neurodiversity as a movement is really young. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, I feel like we're kind of at the forefront. And I have a lot of ambitions for what this kind of thing could become. Last night, we had our first social meeting of the entire club, where we made PowerPoint presentations about things we were interested in and watched funny YouTube videos. And every single person there was neurodivergent.
Love it.
And in the future, we're hoping to record webinars about different aspects of neurodivergence, bring on guest speakers, having some robust peer mentoring programs, and hopefully at some point be able to kind of consult on legislation.
Wow.
There's just so many things I hope to do, but just the groundwork has been set, and it's just the thing I'm most excited about, because at this point at 19, I just really understand that neurodivergence is something that is growing and needs to be accepted and nurtured, and we need a space and we need a community, and I'm thrilled to be a part of building that at my school.
I love it. Thank you for taking us on that journey of what you've been working on, like so many things in such a short amount of time. Really, really incredible. Oh my gosh, I want to keep going. We have to stop. This has been incredible. Thank you so much, Julie. Thank you so much, Ryan. Where can people find you and connect with you? And I want to also impress upon parents listening, share this episode out with families who have children who are neurodivergent, but also if you have children in your family who are neurodivergent, I think this is a great episode to listen to with your children, because I think that, Ryan, you've shared so many beautiful examples of what's possible, also like when to ask for help and how to ask for help and ask for support. And then also in terms of advocacy, how kids can get involved in advocacy, or young people can get involved in advocacy in so many different ways that are not just impactful, like culturally, but also can, I think, sound like feel really rewarding to the individual. So I'm grateful for all that. So I know, Ryan, you're on LinkedIn. And so we will link to your LinkedIn in the show notes. Anywhere else that you want people to follow you?
Yeah. So aside from LinkedIn right now, pretty much the only thing is my Instagram, where I'm not expecting any DMs or anything, but if anyone wants, I'd respond and be happy to connect. At some point in the future, I do want to be making neurodiversity related content and maybe start a podcast, maybe start a coaching practice. I want to make any promises I can't keep, but
we'll send people there and they can follow you and see what happens.
Yeah. If you follow me, Instagram, LinkedIn, whatnot, once those things come about, you'll be the first to know.
And then Julie, what about you?
So motherquest.com is a great place to land. There's a podcast, a free Facebook community. Ryan and I have several episodes we've recorded together. So if people want to go deeper on some of the things that he shared today, they can tune into those episodes. And then we also did that Spark session for neurodivergent students. And that is a replay, and the map that I mentioned is available for that. So those are just a few resources, and we'll make sure we give you links to all of those things.
Yes. I was going to say, so Julie's going to, and Ryan are going to send me all the links. I will put everything in the show notes so that people can link right through to the everything that was just mentioned specifically. If you go to shamelessmom.com, click on the episode with Julie and Ryan Neal. You'll find everything there. Julie and Ryan, thank you for being here. This was absolutely incredible. I'm so grateful to both of you, and really, really appreciate and honor the work that both of you are doing in this world. And I can't wait to keep watching it all unfold.
Thank you, Sarah. This was so wonderful to be able to do this.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having us. It's been a pleasure.
Mamas, before I let you go, shortly before we were releasing this episode, Julie reached out and she had some new resources for me. So since we recorded the interview, Ryan has launched his own website at ryanjneale.com. Also, Julie sent me some links to interviews that she's done on her Mother's Quest podcast with Ryan. So there'll be links to all those conversations in the show notes. I will link to Ryan's website in the show notes. And then also, Julie and Ryan are collaborating on something that just went live in the South San Francisco Bay Area specifically. So if you're in that area and you want to see what they're working on, they are currently working on a project called Autism Storytelling Project. So if you go to autismstorytellingproject.com, they're granting autistic storytellers the opportunity to share creative projects about their life, and applications are currently live. So all of those goodies can be found if you go to shamelessmom.com, click on the episode with Julie and Ryan. I'll have everything linked up and you can go find these great resources and support Julie and Ryan's work from wherever you're at. Thank you so much for joining me in the Shameless Mom Academy today. I really, really appreciate you being here, and I hope you learned something new. As always, this conversation will be continued over in our free private Facebook group. You can join that group by going to shamelessmom.com/Facebook to connect with other shameless moms just like you. Additionally, if this is your first time listening to the show, know that we are here every Monday and Wednesday with a brand new episode. So make sure you subscribe. Go to whatever podcast app you use and subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode. You can do that directly if you go to shamelessmom.com/review. That will put you in Apple Podcasts, where you can click on the subscribe button, and you can also leave a review. If you scroll down a little bit, you can leave a 5-star review. You can write a few sentences letting me know what you thought about the show. If you let me know how the show has impacted you in becoming a more shameless mom, you might be nominated to be Shameless Mom of the Week. Also, please share this episode. My goal is to help more mamas be more shameless every damn day. So please do share this episode. You can take a screenshot of the episode on your phone and then share it out on social media. Tag me at the Shameless Mom Academy on Facebook or Instagram. I'm quick to reply and eager to send you Facebook love and love to be connected to all of you. So again, thank you for being here. I can't wait to be back here again with you in just a couple days. And until then, no matter what you do today, make sure you do it shamelessly.
Hey, are you a parent of a teenager? Are you feeling overwhelmed about how to be what they need while also holding limits and boundaries that keep them safe? Are you tired of conversations that negate how messy this season of parenting is? Well, I've got you. My name is Casey O'Rourke. I am a positive discipline trainer, parent coach, and the host of the Joyful Courage podcast. Every week, I come to you with an interview, digging into tough topics with experts I trust and solo shows that go deep into the personal growth and mindset needed to raise teens in a way that grows them into confident, capable young people. I am not afraid of getting real about the intersection of conscious parenting and the teen years, while also bringing in vulnerability, humor, and lightness. I'm walking the path with you and honored to serve. Listen to Joyful Courage on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you consume podcasts.